Hello and welcome. I'm John Burns, and this is my new restyled podcast, Outdoors in Scotland. My guest today is a man I spoke to nearly 2 years ago now, when his first book about beavers came out, and he's now written a second book about his life with wildlife. And I thought it'd be a great idea to have him along now. So my guest is Derek Gow. Hi, Derek. How are you?
Hi, John. Very well indeed. Thank you. How are you?
I'm brilliant. Thanks. I'm brilliant. I'm hoping that we get a summer right now. We haven't had one up here yet. I don't know what it's like. We're down with you.
It's actually jolly cold today, in fairness. I mean, we had a nice afternoon yesterday, but not very prepossessing today, I'm afraid.
Yeah. It's been, we've had a pretty cold May. So let's hope in July manage to pick up, you know. Well, it's nearly 2 years since you and I spoke about when your book on beavers, Rewilding Beavers, came out. I don't know. I wanted to ask you what you thought about where beavers are. It appears to me, at least, that beavers are kind of going from strength to strength in the wild in Britain right now. Is that right?
Well, they are. Certainly, the numbers are increasing, which is good news. I mean, it's together with a colleague, we sat down the other day in the pub and tried to figure out approximately how many we think there are, and we think probably somewhere in the region of about 3,000, you know, animals that are living wild in rivers, animals that are breeding in enclosures. We think that's probably a credible figure, somewhere in the region of 2,500 to 3,000. So yes, it's they're here. It's going to be very difficult to eliminate them or retard their eventual progress. But at a time when things are so difficult, and when nature's properties are just, you know, so eroded and so destroyed, we should be returning this animal quickly. And instead, what's happening in Scotland is they are still killing animals year on year, though they talk now more about translocation. Very little has actually happened. And the only translocation that has occurred to the red kite feeding centre at Argartie was just laden with an absolutely laden burden of administration. And this is the central problem, is that when you look at it, you've now got governments, certainly in Scotland and in Wales, in England, if not in Wales, saying that, yes, we're going to do this. Yes, this animal is going to be restored. But to do it, you're going to have to produce a small encyclopedia of answers for the very many complicated forums that they're going to expect you to infill. It's certainly no liberal and liberating experience. It's going to be long, slow, and tedious.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're talking about, obviously, is the issue that beavers obviously engineer the landscape. They're a bit like us in that sense, in that they're one of the few animals that actually changes its own environment, and that also obviously, but that brings the beaver quite regularly into conflict with man.
It really doesn't. I mean, this is a misnomer. At the end of the day, it brings it occasionally into conflict with our interests, but the vast majority of beavers in Britain in river valleys, which are well wooded, are going to live out long lives without ever creating an issue for us. So this right at the beginning of this process of restoration, when there's such enthusiasm from wider society with regard to the restoration of this creature, and in fairness from very many landowners as well, it's just crazy that what we're doing is focusing on a problem that's going to arise maybe 20, 30 years in the future, when there are many beavers, and which, you know, we know exactly how to deal with, because all the blueprints for doing so have been well developed by the Europeans and are tested and trialed. And what we're doing is focusing on the problem and not addressing the main central issue at the moment, which is the absolute disintegration of other life, because we created such toxic living environments for it. So it's not a big issue at all. It's been made into a big issue, but it's not something that we need to really be worried about as we begin this, what should be a joyous journey of the rediscovery of this important animal that we've lived with for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's I'm glad to hear you say that, and I think that the obviously the reintroduction of the beaver will obviously change our rivers, will change our environment, for the better, really, and make things a lot more diverse.
All for the better, absolutely.
And also, one of the things that's coming across, obviously, because of climate change and flooding, is the role that beavers have in flood prevention, which is really important, I think.
And not only flood prevention, it's what's coming next. It's drought as well. I mean, just the other day, I was doing a conference with Anglian Water. And, I mean, it seems hard to credit it. But if you go to the east of England, you have now more of an allocatable headage of water per individual in Sudan than you have there.
So it's not just that.
Yeah, it's not just the floodwaters that these animals can help calm and still. It's the fact that they can hold water very effectively and very efficiently on the land, raising the groundwater levels by doing so behind their dams, you know, where there are fissures and then the rock beneath that. There's also evidence that they help to recharge aquifers. And every study there has been of these small pool systems in great complexes in, you know, surrounded by woodland shows it's a much more effective way of storing water. You lose much less by transpiration than you do in big reservoirs. So when it comes to it, this is an animal which has much to offer us, you know, in terms of creating landscapes that are both flood resilient, drought resilient, and also, you know, when it comes to filtering the water that goes through their dam systems, you know, infinitely less toxic than they would otherwise be as a result of all the various discharges we impose in the wider environment.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that as well. Tell us a little bit. One question that I wondered about was as you know, the salmon are much, much depleted in our rivers. Is there a role, do you think, that beavers would play in hopefully bringing back salmon stocks?
Yes, of course. I mean, even though, you know, the kind of diehard fisheries extremists will tell you that the dams are barriers against the travel of my passage of migratory fish, there is no evidence that suggests this. Now, if you speak to North American fisheries specialists, they will laughingly tell you that the opposite is true, that you cannot build resilient stocks of migratory game fish unless you have the beaver. Because what beaver dams do is they act as great larders of invertebrates. So you've got, you know, because you've a lot of decomposing vegetation there, you have complex communities of aquatic invertebrates, and that of course is essentially fish food. They hold water in great abundance. So my own farm here, you know, in medieval drainage ditch systems, which would contain no water at all by the time you get to this time of year, there's an abundance of pools and cascades and inlets, all created by the beavers. And if the beavers weren't there doing it, there wouldn't be any water. And even the stupidest fisherman is going to be able to recognize the fact that, you know, no water, no fish. They create lays, you know, by felling trees into the water for the big game fish will rest under. They create, you know, again, the same sort of structures. You know, the felled tree heads are used by fish fry. They provide spawning gravels. They provide life for lampreys and eels. So if you're looking at, you know, a whole complex of aquatic life, of whole complex of fisheries, there's no argument about it. Beavers are a good thing. And the only reason why these old duffers have picked the no answer is because they're living in a past that's just nonsensical. We need these animals as part of an overall functioning ecology of our river systems very desperately, and fish need them too.
Well, yeah, and it's great to see that the beaver, I think the beaver's here to stay now. I think it's we're not going back. Tell us a little bit. I understand also that you're also involved in conservation of the water vole. That's an animal that's not doing so well, and I wonder what state are we at with the water vole, do you think?
Well, we're in a bad place. I mean, when I started working with them, it was reckoned that the population had declined by 97%. That was in 2004. And now we reckon there may be a national population of between 70 and 130,000. So they've declined from, you know, 1.2 million in 2004 to this now. There's no way you can dress it up as a success. And it's because what we've done with this little creature is we've drained all the wetlands, near all the big wetlands are gone. We wanted all the land for agriculture or for whatever other purpose we had planned, and we pushed and pushed and pushed this species back into a tiny narrow corridor of living space, and I don't think we even hoped they would do well there. We never thought about them at all.
Yeah,
we didn't mean to
to really kind of clinch them to extinction. But that's what's happened. So I've been involved with captive breeding water voles for perhaps the last quarter century. The reason why we're captive breeding them is there are environments which still exist where, you know, perhaps past land use, like you know, the over excavation of drainage ditches during the summer, or you know, the introduction of mink, which have basically spread through the landscape and which kill them very effectively, has wiped them out in the past. And what we've done is we have provided very large stocks for cattle of captive bred water voles for reintroduction. And many of the projects that basically where we've done this, there are huge populations now that are doing very well, because some of the old issues that the species had to encounter are no longer valid. And when you look at this animal, it's actually a very tough little animal. If you put out sufficient animals of sufficient genetic diversity at the right time of year in the right numbers, they can take and go on and do very well. And I think it's this Monday coming, we're just about to announce that we're releasing a 30,000th water vole from our captive breeding program.
Wow.
At a place called Threntum near Stafford. And that's, you know, quite a nice milestone to mark.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I know that I suppose water voles have got their exactly their backs to the wall, but their backs to the bank, maybe. But let's hope that's something we can also turn around. But well, the last time I spoke to you, you just published your book about rewilding the beaver, and I believe you're about on the 16th of this month, you're about to release your next book, which is, I think, I'm getting this right, Birds, Beasts, and Bedlam. What's that all about, Derek?
Well, that's all about. It's about a life I spent with animals of all sorts of all different sorts. I mean, I've had a lot to do with beavers for about a quarter of a century, but, you know, in the same sort of time, I've worked in zoos, but zoos are always really focused on British wildlife rather than anything else. So though I have kept and looked after some European species like chamois and European bison, I've always, you know, had my principal interest has been in the conservation of native mammals. So I've worked with a whole range of different species, from beavers to wildcats to white storks, harvest mice, and now things like glowworms. And what the book's about is, it's really about, you know, the course of life. I mean, it's about the funny things that have happened, about the sad things that have happened. It also takes a bit of a look at nature conservation and how it actually works, because, you know, we live in a time where there are very many people making a big fuss about what they want to do and how we need to save this, how we need to save that. And very often, when you look behind the facade of what some of these organizations claim, there's not an awful lot happening at all. And the inertia behind, you know, this apparent facade of being incredibly busy doing things is really shocking. And also, there's a very real reluctance when it comes to some of the more conservative organizations to do very much at all. They're very, you know, so for example, things like the White Stork Project was actually roundly opposed by organizations like the Sussex Wildlife Trust at the time, you know, who just couldn't get their heads round the fact that this, you know, really surprising project, which was going to deliver a bird back as a breeding entity that in Lower Britain, that was, you know, big, visible, very used to living with people. Indeed, they lived alongside us in the roofs of our houses and community and dwellings for all time. That this would actually create, you know, huge, wider social enthusiasm for nature, which of course it's done exactly. And all they did was what they normally do is come up with a whole list of excuses as to why nothing can be done, and then fight like hell to ensure that nothing was done rather than something. And when you look at, you know, there's like a festival in Hastings called Jack of the Green, where, you know, people kind of like, you know, paint all these kind of like, make all these fat green man wood masks and dye their hair green and paint their bodies green. And it's, you know, a kind of celebration of a rite of spring. And it was held about 3-4 weeks ago. And 3-4 weeks ago, there are people who've made life-size puppet storks, and they're walking through the city streets with, you know, holding these creatures up and making their wings flap. It's generated huge enthusiasm. Hundreds of thousands of people have dropped correspondence to Knepp Castle you know, which hosts the main breeding population of the birds, saying just how, you know, thrilled they are that these things are living in the landscape again around them now. And all the people who said no have just gone away. But it's really, really sad that this time of terrible danger for nature, when we're, you know, really approaching a ground zero type living situation on this island for so many other creatures, like the water vole and the curlew, you know, things that used to be familiar, lapwings, all long gone.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you actually turn around and say, well, there are things we can do. What about doing this? People would love it. The answer is no. It's a desperate betrayal of what they should be there to do.
Yeah, I think, I think in the Highlands, I've seen there is the beginning of change here. I think it's very slow. There are some areas where some landowners are allowing, you know, the forest to come back and are allowing a degree of rewilding to take place. It feels a little, but it's very, very slow and it's very, very small.
Yeah, it's very, very slow, and everything that's going wrong is going wrong very, very fast.
Yeah,
and that's the problem, is we are not matching the speed of recovery, and we shouldn't kid ourselves in any sense that we are to the speed of desecration.
And one of the challenges, I think, to wildlife, I don't know if you'd agree, I mean, but it certainly appears to me that we do have very rapidly changing weather patterns as a result of global warming. And I think it must be incredibly difficult for wildlife to actually adapt to those changes that are taking place in such a short time span. Is that right?
It's absolutely the case. And what you're also going to find is that many things are already isolated. I mean, this idea that we live in an island where, you know, species like common dormice can easily move through landscapes without issue, you know, it's just nonsense. You know, so many things are physically fragmented. You know, there are tiny patch of one creature here, tiny patch of another creature there. You know, things like sand lizards confined entirely to heathlands in the south of England and sand dune systems there as well. And when you go to other countries and you see them living in soils right the way through a landscape where there is no sea coast, you realize that, you know, this whole process of us confining and smashing creatures, you know, whatever they may be, you know, from tiny insectivorous plants to pine martens you know, anything else you care to examine into these pockets of environments is something that we've really been doing for a very long time. You know, this island, you know, it has been occupied by people since pretty much over the course of the last 12,000 years. And when you start to look at things like, you know, history and heritage of people at Neanderthals who lived alongside, you know, many of the creatures that we still, you know, think of as, you know, everyday's familiar storybook animals, they lived with these things for 400,000 years plus. And then things like beavers emerged 40 million years ago. We've been destroying for a very long time. It's our history, our heritage, and our culture. And we are nearing end game for very many creatures now. And what's required, if we're going to go forward in this time of very difficult climate change as well, caused by us, is that we really start to look at our attitudes with regard to the other creatures that share this health with us. Because if we don't, there's going to be next to nothing left. So the book is a bit of a wake-up call, but it's also a bit of a celebration of things that have happened or are happening that can go well. The White Stork Project is a great example of how, with the right kind of vision, the right kind of people, the right kind of imagination, you can do things very fast. You know, we brought in hundreds of birds to support that project from Warsaw Zoo, where they, you know, perhaps had hit power lines, had been orphaned by their parents or whatever else, and the zoo were taking care of them in that excellent bird hospital for a while. And it's those kind of projects and those kind of, you know, commitments to do something at scale that we really desperately need now. We're also just too focused on doing things that are just small. So the book talks about that sort of thing, and I think contains some thoughts about just how we could act to make this better.
Now, you do, I understand, I think you have the honour to be fairly unique in that you're the only person I know who's been bitten by a wildcat. Is that right?
Well, I'm sure other people have been bitten by them, but once you've been bitten once, you sure as hell wouldn't want to be bitten.
Is that right?
Once again, a heart's like hell. It bit me right the way through. the fingernails of both hands, all of which came off.
Really?
And it did it with an easy, consummate, fiendish enjoyment. So entirely my own fault. Again, if you read the book, you'll see the story about how was a bad workman always blames his tools. Well, I'm blaming the catching net, which wasn't working well. But even though the equipment may not have been working well, my own actions were incredibly stupid, and that's why it kind of came out of the encounter slightly better than I did.
It does sound like the sort of thing you wouldn't want to do twice, you know. But no. what do you think? I mean, the wildcat obviously is also very endangered, and I think endangered partly just through interbreeding with domestic cats as well. Is that right?
Well, it's certainly been diminished by interbreeding with domestic cats, but that situation is also a historic one. So if you look at where this animal was by the time you get to the beginning of the 20th century, this woodland creature has been completely exterminated throughout all of the British Isles, though it's not believed they ever existed in Ireland. They've been exterminated throughout the main island, and it's been pushed as a relic of this once, once abundant widespread species up into the far northwest of Scotland by gamekeepers, the vermin acts, by the fur traders, whatever. When it gets there, it's isolated in a landscape of mountain and moor, and of course there are very few of them left. So the gamekeepers pretty nearly finish them off, but then the First World War comes along, the gamekeepers go, and they never come back in the same numbers. And the Forestry Commission starts. The wildcats move out of the northwest coast of Scotland into the commission plantations while they are growing. So perhaps for the first 5 years, you've got a lot of tall grass and decent vole habitat and rabbits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the wildcats, you know, prosper for a time. But then when the conifers shade out the understory, there's nothing to eat. So these poor creatures are in a terrible situation. They move out into a habitat that looks as if it's going to be prepossessingly good, and then all of a sudden isn't, but there's more and more of it. And as they move back through these landscape of roulette-type opportunities, the males, which move typically well in front of the females in the population, the only mates they ever encounter are domestic cats. So they breed with domestic cats. You have a whole complex population of these wildcat hybrids now in Scotland, which is a situation that's quite unique really within Europe.
Right.
And and even though there are a seam of pure wildcats left, or pure air type wildcats left, you still have poor habitat, you have little deciduous woodland cover in the wider landscape, you have gamekeepers who will still willingly kill them, you have domestic cat disease, and you have many hybrids around them. So I know the project that's currently being developed by Saving Wildcats is a noble effort to release 20 kittens or whatever else it is in the Cairngorms. Mm-hmm. If we're serious about restoring this animal to the whole of the British Isles, we have to produce very many more of them from the captive bred population and start to look at where else we can put them. And of course, as soon as you look at England, you have a much, much, you know, it's a warmer, lusher environment. There are more deciduous woodlands. There are no hybrids at all, and precious few feral cats in many forests in southern Britain. Mm-hmm. And that's why we believe it'd be a really good idea to start captive breeding more wildcats and reintroducing them here. And the only problem with it is a very, very small animal. It's not an issue, for any significant users of land, who would otherwise be impacted by wild living creatures. It's purely political. It's down to a shocking inertia again amongst the statutory nature conservation authorities and others, who just don't want to see it happen. And that's not reflective of the way that people in wider society feel about the reintroduction of this creature. If you ask people, very many people are in favour of its return, and that's what we should be doing.
And is that a real possibility, do you think, in England? Or are there very sort of conservative voices raised against the wildcat?
No, there are virtually no conservative voices raised in England against the wildcat. We're hoping the Devon Wildlife Trust will be able to start a feasibility study just shortly to look and explain to people what wildcats are, look at any issues there may be, talk those through with people and get them to a point where within 12 months, we have a clear understanding about what could be done with wildcats and perhaps some of the best habitat that remains for them on the Cornish Devon sea cliffs. We've had some decent chats with the guys in Scotland who coordinate the breeding program, and they tell us that they are very supportive of the idea of reintroducing wildcats to England, which is good to hear. It's all been, you know, a bit slow. You know, it would have been great to start making progress a few years ago, but there are plenty of cats in captivity that can provide a breeding stock for a project like this. So there really is no obstacle with regard to doing it, other than, I'm afraid, inertia. That's it. We're just too good at looking for reasons why we shouldn't do things in nature conservation. And we need to grow up and develop more of an agricultural mindset when it comes to production. And when the opportunity comes along, get on with it. That's what's going to need to have to happen if we're going to save species, for any kind of future that's meaningful.
But that sounds very hopeful for the wildcat in England then.
It sounds hopeful, but many a twist. So I'll believe it when we open the box and let the first six kittens go.
Well, that'd be an amazing thing, though, wouldn't it? To be able to do that would be fantastic, you know. And what other animals do you talk about? I mean, obviously, it sounds quite a wide ranging book. Well, what other animal encounters do you talk about in your book?
Well, there's just some fun stories about some of the guys I worked with, because when I worked in zoos, a lot of the old circus people were still there. And even though, you know, circuses are now a thing of the past, they were pretty colourful characters. I mean, a lot of them, you know, had led lives that, to say the least, were flamboyant.
And, right.
you know, I met people who danced naked on the backs of elephants and dealt guns to African dictators. So they were a very unusual bunch of people. So there's stories in there about a journey we made years ago. I collected some European bison from a couple of zoos when I worked in Scotland, and about a fairly harrowing journey we had to make back to the central Scottish belt with a bull bison that started punching holes in the side of its cattle trailer, all the way back from Kent. So that was, that was entertaining. And then there are some other, you know, fun guys that used to work in a zoo environment. There was a story by a chap called Alf Robertson who had a big fight with a monkey called Jojo, and it's entertaining reading, but it's illustrative of the kind of people that used to work in these kind of institutions before they kind of grew up into the more modern version of arcs that they like to view themselves as being now.
That sounds a really fascinating book, actually. I obviously, you know, it's a book. It sounds like a book that's got a lot to say, but also a lot of stories that are human and also animal, I guess. So something for everybody at some level about those sort of things. Your book, go on.
No, it's that. It's a very human book, because when it comes to the things that we look to do with other creatures, we're looking to save things like frogs and tiny bejeweled butterflies or plants, not because they're massively important in their own right, but because, you know, we value them, we love them. And therefore, you know, we've had this, though we've had an incredibly abusive relationship with nature in our time on this planet, there are also, you know, many examples of people really cherishing things. So it's a book that, you know, hopefully will make people think about, you know, what is and what isn't important in life, and the distractions that we encounter along the way, and about really what their commitment should be to doing what they possibly can to assist the natural world where possible.
That sounds great. And so that's available from the 16th of June.
16th of June from Chelsea Green.
Great. Thanks very much. That's Birds, Beasts and Bedlam by Derek Gow. Thanks very much, Derek. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Lovely talking to you as well, John. Thank you very much indeed.
And that was Derek Gow, who's an uncompromising champion for rewilding in the UK. I'll put links to both Derek's books on the podcast page, and I'm sure you'll really enjoy what are Derek's very entertaining and forthright views. Just to let you know that you can now follow Outdoors in Scotland on Apple, Google Podcasts and Spotify. So if you've enjoyed this, don't forget to go along there and click the follow, and you can hear episodes in the future. Just to let you know also that I am hoping to get along to Beleskin House on the shores of Loch Ness, which is the old haunt of the occultist and mountaineer Alistair Crowley, and I'll be talking to folk who are renovating that house and bringing it back to life. It's a really fascinating place to go, and I'm sure you'll enjoy that. I've hoped you've enjoyed this podcast. I've been John Burns, and I'll see you for more episodes of Outdoors in Scotland. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.